A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Those few words have stirred up a lot of impassioned debate since they were put into the Bill of Rights as the Second Amendment to the Constitution. Gun rights advocates have invoked them when there's talk of tightening regulations on gun ownership. Gun control proponents have interpreted them to support their cause. But what did the people who added that Second Amendment to the Constitution have in mind? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What does the Second Amendment say about the right of individuals to bear arms? And what does it mean when it refers to a well-regulated militia? We'll look at that and also two other amendments from the Bill of Rights that come into play from time to time and recently as well. That would be the 9th and the 10th. Our guest once again is John Kaminsky, Director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution.
Well, welcome back to University of the Year.
Good to be back. Thank you.
It is amazing how these amendments that are written so long ago are in the news every day. You know, the arguments over what it means, they just don't stop, do they?
No. The framers of the Constitution and the Americans who adopted this Constitution understood that they were not writing a Constitution for a short term. It was a long term, and it was expected that it would address key fundamental issues that people were concerned with. These men who drafted and adopted the Constitution, many of them were very, very well read. They had read political and philosophical writings over the course of hundreds of years, and they had a profound understanding of human nature. And that combination was brought to bear when they wrote the Constitution and then the amendments that followed.
Why did they have to, you know, why couldn't they get it in the Constitution to begin with? Why have this Bill of Rights so soon after the Constitution? Was it like P.S.?
No. The Constitutional Convention was called not to preserve rights. In fact, that was maybe one of the problems that the country had. There were too many rights. Licentiousness, some were saying. And so it was called for five reasons. One, to preserve the Union. Two, to strengthen Congress. Three, to take away some powers from the states. Four, to fight the economic depression that they were in, give government, the central government, some economic powers. And then fifth, to restore the image of America in the world, which had been lost over the last five or so years. They had gotten tremendous reputation during the fighting of the Revolution, but they had lost a lot of that reputation lately.
Do you have a sense of how important it is to know the intent of the framers of the Constitution? It seems to me that's one big divide in terms of the way these debates are framed. It's, well, on the one hand, the framers meant this, but then on the other hand, people are saying, well, yes, but this is today, and you can't just go with the 18th century.
Yes. I would say it's virtually impossible to come up with an intent. You can come up with various intents. There are Federalists and there are Anti-Federalists. But that's on a whole spectrum. It's amusing to me that I find people say all the time that Thomas Jefferson was an Anti-Federalist. Now, that's just not true. Thomas Jefferson wanted the Constitution to be adopted. And if I had the ability to rank people, where were they as far as liking this Constitution and disliking it? Jefferson would be sort of toward the middle, I would say. But those that disliked it, I would put Alexander Hamilton there, and I would put James Madison there. Now, that would be shocking for people to hear that two of the writers of the Federalist Papers are most against the Constitution. And that's exactly what happened after the Constitutional Convention. They didn't like what the final product was. They wanted something else, and yet they eventually took Madison 6 weeks to come to this conclusion. It's better than what we have, the Articles of Confederation, and therefore we're going to work for it and try to achieve it, and we'll get more. Now, one of the main arguments, Emily asked the question earlier about the lack of a Bill of Rights, they drafted the Constitution, and when they were finished drafting it, there were motions for a Bill of Rights. And they realized if they opened up that issue, everything else would be on the table. And they just didn't want to chance that. And so they went with the Constitution without a Bill of Rights. And it almost killed the Constitution because there was such a tremendous demand for a Bill of Rights.
When we say Bill of Rights, we mean individual Bill of Rights or individual and states' rights?
Individual rights. And that's the other side of the question. States' rights was the second large issue. So there are two overriding issues. Anti-Federalists objected to everything in the Constitution, to be sure. But the two big issues is the lack of a Bill of Rights and the federal-state relationship. And so that's the second issue. Will the states survive? Or will there be, in their words, a consolidated government?
Gosh, we're still arguing that one, aren't we?
Yes, that's absolutely. Well, let's turn to the Second Amendment. What prompted the inclusion of language about a well-regulated militia and the right of the people to keep and bear arms? What are some of the sort of backgrounds behind those words?
Certainly, this is an issue that was prevalent in England and in the American colonies. We see in the English Bill of Rights, for instance, that James II is condemned for arming the Papists and disarming Protestants. You have to understand at that time, only about 50 years or so after Catholicism was eliminated in England under Henry VIII, and now we're under the Stuart kings after Elizabeth's death in 1603, that the Papists are thought to be a radical, well-armed, and revolutionary group of people. And there are various laws passed against them. It so happens that after James I and then Charles I and the English Civil War, then the restoration of the monarchy, Charles II and then his brother James II, Charles II flirts with Catholicism. James II comes out of the closet. He is a Catholic. His second wife is a Catholic, and their son will be a Catholic. And so he starts promoting, against the laws, Catholics to various civil and military positions. And he starts arming them, and his opponents are disarmed, and the opponents are Protestants. And so there you see the state of the issue in England, that Protestants could bear arms and Catholics could not bear arms.
I see. So there's early on this feeling that the right to bear arms is a way of preserving protection against domination by another group.
Exactly. And the other thing in England is for a long time they had the opinion that standing armies were dangerous. What protected England was the sea. And because it was an island, difficult to invade and conquer, and their protection was primarily in the Navy. And the Navy didn't present much of a danger domestically.
Because they were aquatic.
Yes. and so you have that propensity throughout English history and then transferred over to American history that a standing army in peacetime is dangerous.
But what you need is apparently then some kind of preparedness that will enable you to call up an army on short notice.
Exactly. And that is the militia. And the militia is all able-bodied men. That is 16 to 60. That is who the militia is. And there is a expectation, a duty that you serve in the militia. So one of the key issues all the time is about conscientious objectors. Are they freed from that duty?
Was that really a big phenomenon other than Quakers in 18th century America?
That was a big enough phenomenon with the Quakers, and there are others as well, yes, uh-huh. Mennonites and others as well. And so this comes up, and it's a heated issue, particularly in Pennsylvania, but all over you find this. And you'll see that in state constitutions, various ones, there are protections for conscientious objectors. But what it shows, I think, very interestingly, is that there's an expectation that people will be bearing arms, that it's not just a right, but it's a duty. And if you don't do your duty because of religious reasons, you should be allowed to adhere to your religious beliefs. But there's a consequence, and the consequence is a substitute. And that could be in the form of either money or another person you pay for another person to serve your duty.
Wow, that plays again during the Civil War, doesn't it?
Yes.
You have a choice paying $300 or going yourself. Now, as far as this duty to bear arms, is it always framed then in terms of a militia, or do we see that if not duty, you have the right to bear arms as an individual?
Both. It's interesting to see the situation today. You have this partisan debate going on, and both sides have very, very solid historical arguments. And that's pretty easy to understand because both sides do have solid historical arguments. They don't want to credit the arguments of the other side. They want to discredit that, saying only our side is right. Well, both sides are right. Throughout English and American colonial and early American national history, both strands are correct. The right of individuals to own arms, bear arms, and the necessity to have a well-regulated militia. You want individuals to have arms for various reasons. Obviously, national defense if there is an invasion, but also protection, police protection that they don't have readily available from banditti, they call them. And in America, Indians, when you're out isolated, you need some protection.
And some 90% of the country was rural at that point.
Absolutely. And then you have protection for what they call varmints, wolves, let's say, or other kinds of animals that would feed on crops or livestock. You have to protect your property. You also want to have weapons for hunting and fowling. This is sometimes very, very important in sustaining your family. So these are key issues for individuals, and they're always talked about, and then naturally the self-defense. I failed to mention one, that is the tyranny of government, too. They're always concerned about that. And so the individuals need to be able to mobilize when their government, looking back at James II, for instance, in English history, to stand up to them.
We know from reading the newspapers every day that people get shot in domestic violence, in all kinds of school tragedies. That's certainly not what the original writers of this amendment had in mind. Were there early instances of arms being used for the wrong reasons? When do you start seeing kind of controversy over the danger of individuals with guns?
That's present all the time. And you see this in the newspapers reported and in private letters. They will talk about accidents that happen, sometimes very tragic, sometimes somewhat comical. But naturally, there's violence and there's crime. And in English history and in early American history, there are many crimes that are capital crimes. You're paid with your life. Highwaymen, for instance, which would not be given much of a penalty later on, and certainly not today. There were no penitentiaries in early America. That's a phenomenon that comes about at about the time of the Constitution. And so Jefferson, for instance, when he goes back to Virginia in 1777 after writing the Declaration of Independence, he's chairing a committee to recodify the laws of Virginia. And what he does doesn't get approved right away, some of these laws, but the penalty for various crimes are reduced. There are over 40 capital crimes when Jefferson starts out. There are only two when he finishes, and that is treason and homicide, murder. Those Jefferson revisions don't get adopted right away in Virginia.
So we have the right for individuals to protect themselves and to regulate their and defend their estates against, varmints and various banditti and other incursions. And we have this militia, but it's all about power, isn't it, when you're writing a constitution? Who has what power? So who would have power over the militias under the Second Amendment?
Well, not under the Second Amendment, but under the Constitution, the body of the Constitution. The states are the ones that will regulate the militias, and they are to work with the federal government so that there's a uniformity. They saw how militias were so different during the war of the revolution, and they knew that they needed a certain uniformity there and that the general officers would be appointed, again, by the central government, but that the states would train the militia unless they didn't. And if they didn't, then the central government could step in. And the central government could be called up. The militia could be called up by Congress to use it in any number of ways. There are various protections in the Constitution, protection for a Republican form of government. And that would be in case, let's say, of a Shays' Rebellion occurring again.
I was going to say, now, when we get to something like that, where you actually have Washington leading the troops to put it down, what's the difference between federal and state militia intervention?
The federal government, they have its own army. And the question is how many men should be in that army. And certainly there was the garrisoning of forts on the frontier. And you also needed some troops in the commercial centers for the enforcement of import duties, customs service. But that military force should be limited, and the militia should be available to be called up. And it wasn't the case with the Whiskey Rebellion. Hamilton wanted to show a force, and so he called up over 10,000 men, and Washington was at the head of it for a very brief time until he saw there was no enemy. They had dispersed, and so it was twofold. One was a little bit of an embarrassment, of an overreaction, but the other was that this is a serious government here. Now, back about 5 years earlier when the Shays' Rebellion took place, Madison was very fearful of that and wanted to create a federal legion, he called it, and Congress, the Confederation Congress, which did not have the authority to do this, did pass a measure to suppress the Indian uprisings on the frontier, which were not occurring. And this was the legion that was going to suppress Shays' Rebellion. Well, in the interim, the state of Massachusetts did suppress the rebellion with its own forces, a somewhat similar, not exactly the militia, because in actuality, the Shaysites were the militia. And so they created a special army that did suppress Shays.
When you listen to the current debate over the Second Amendment, do you ever feel that we need an amendment to the Second Amendment because we're dealing with words that were written back when there were varmints in a very rural early America, and we're applying those words to such a different world?
It might be helpful, but I'm not sure how long that Bill of Rights might well be. The framers of this, they had a deep understanding of what they were talking about, but they also, it was simplistic in their understanding as well. They knew exactly what freedom of the press meant. Yet if they would see the complications today, and this is true certainly of the right to bear arms, they'd be astonished that there'd be such a disagreement. They would say, look at the words. The words are simple. It says the twofold meaning, the right for individuals to bear arms and the right and the necessity to have a militia and to be able to have people trained. And so I'm not sure what a further exemplification of these principles would be if we had an opportunity to expand upon them. The minutia might just be overwhelming.
What about other countries? Do they have a Second Amendment equivalent?
I believe most of them do as far as militia is concerned, but most will have severe restrictions upon individuals. And certainly the following generation believe that there should be restrictions and regulations. They often would say in their constitutions, state constitutions, under the authority of law. And so it wasn't felt that this was a blanket a right that everybody should have whatever weapon they wanted, and they could use those weapons in any way. But it was felt that it was a necessity. Jefferson referred to it one time as a necessity that every farmhouse should have.
If there's concern about a standing army, wouldn't a militia constitute possibly a standing army in peacetime?
They didn't think so. A standing army would be men that would be under arms all the time, in uniform, in a garrison, ready to be put to use. And that use, they felt, would be only twofold. One, against a foreign country, and two, against the people of their own country. And so they were very fearful about that. Now, a militia, these are folks that are barbers and shoemakers and farmers. And they come together maybe once a month, and they're trained. And then they go back. They're not military people.
In this balance or attempted balance between militias and the federal government, who has control over martial law, and how does that play into the relationship?
Martial law goes into effect anytime there's violence going on, whatever that violence happens to be, particularly war, but also rebellion. And whatever government is exercising the control, if it happens to be the state government, or in the case of the new constitution, the militia being under the control of the federal government, under the president. In both cases, there is the fear that Americans have that martial law will be in force against their militias, whether it be the governor and their state constitution will protect against that, or the president and the federal constitution, the Bill of Rights should protect against that. And so there's not an objection to martial law during times of war. The danger is that the ordinary folks serving in the militia will be subject to martial law in peacetime. And that is a very dangerous thing. That is potential tyranny being foisted upon the military of various states.
And so the Second Amendment addresses that how?
It doesn't. It's again, one of those issues. There are many, many issues surrounding the right to bear arms that are not incorporated in those few words in the Bill of Rights. They knew what they were talking about, but this is one of them that they were very, very concerned about, that martial law would not be in effect unless a war was going on.
What about the problem of vigilante justice? I mean, were there early instances of armed men coming together and sort of taking the law in their own hands and thereby sort of circumventing due process?
I would imagine there is. There's not much record of that in the early founding period. The courts were very swift in their judgment and very little appeal. And so if you were found guilty of a capital crime, you'd be dead within a week. And so justice was pretty quick and
fast
pretty
enough. You didn't need vigilantes.
Right.
We're going to look at the Ninth Amendment when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. There is the Ninth Amendment, the Ninth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, part of the Bill of Rights, and it sounds really abstract on the face of it, but obviously this was a matter of some concern, considerable concern, to the framers of the Constitution also. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest John Kaminsky.
Yes, this was a very important concern. Throughout colonial American history, Americans wrote down their rights. This was different from their English heritage. In England, rights were embodied in the common law. And whenever a monarch violated the rights, when it went too far, the people, in the form of members of parliament or the barons at Runnymede with Magna Carta, they put in writing the violations of rights. And they said to the king, don't do this again if you want our support. And so, but the rights in general that were put on paper were not being created. Those rights were already there in the common law. In America, this was changed because we didn't have lawyers in America to draw upon the common law. And so there was still a fear and a suspicion of government after the experience of the Stuart kings. After all, 12 of the 13 American colonies were established during the 85-year reign of the Stuart kings. And so they, the Americans, they did a peremptory strike. They listed their rights in documents, saying to their authorities, their governments, don't violate these rights.
What were some of those rights?
They're all the rights that we know of in the Bill of Rights. These rights were sort of magnets to attract immigrants to come there. freedom of religion, for instance. But if you look at one of the great documents, there are over 200 documents that contain rights in colonial America. One of the great documents is the Massachusetts Body of Liberty. It has all of the rights that are in the U.S. Bill of Rights. It was written 50 years before the English Bill of Rights, 150 years before the American Bill of Rights. It has all those rights in the Bill of Rights, but it has also rights for women, rights for children, rights for slaves and servants, indentured servants, rights for aliens, and even rights for animals. You cannot work your horse too hard. You cannot drive your livestock too much without some kind of penalty for you. And so that was 1641. So the Americans were used to writing down their rights. And so when you get this new constitution, I should back up and say, their state constitutions had bills of rights, many of them. Many states had rights embodied in their constitutions. Connecticut had a bill of rights from colonial times that periodically the assemblies would endorse that. So they didn't have a bill of rights in their revolutionary era. They didn't have a revolutionary constitution. They had modernized their charter, and they modernized their Bill of Rights as well from the 1630s. A state like New York passed a statutory Bill of Rights in January 1787. But these rights had all the familiar things: freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, freedom of assembly, freedom of petition, double jeopardy, on and on and on. These protections are there. And consequently, when the Constitution comes along, the federal Constitution being proposed, that gives the central government tremendous power, there's no Bill of Rights. So the Americans, many of them, are quite concerned over this. Their tradition had been, write down our rights so they're there for everyone to see, and especially they're there for the judiciary to use as a weapon to stifle any kind of tyrannical acts that the government might be involved in.
So if we get back to this Ninth Amendment, I'll repeat it again because it's so short, like so many aspects of the Constitution. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people, is this distinction between federal government and state and individuals. And it's kind of a blanket disclaimer saying if we're not mentioning it specifically, it's a state matter.
Well, not a state matter. It's a protection for individuals.
It is specifically
for individuals.
For individuals.
It says for individuals.
Retained by the people.
By the people.
But when
yes.
It says retained by the people, how are they retaining it exactly? I mean, is it a blanket statement where any right somebody thinks they have?
Well, let me explain that different state constitutions have bills of rights. For instance, Virginia. But they don't list all of them. They list quite a few, but not every single one. And so those people in those states are protected by those rights. Now, in the Constitution, in the debate over the Constitution, the Federalists, supporters of the Constitution, they defend the Constitution's lack of a Bill of Rights by saying, if you list a Bill of Rights, you list the rights, if you don't list some, that will then be assumed that you're giving up that right to government.
It's that implication.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so that's the danger. And so you have to come up with a provision that will cover that. And in actuality, in the debate over the Constitution, only two people address that issue. That is, how to solve that problem. And one is Patrick Henry in a speech in the Virginia Ratifying Convention. And the other is a great anti-federalist writer, a federal farmer. They often go by pseudonyms at that time. And both of them address this issue that the Federalists say, if you don't list the right, it's presumed to be given up. And they say, use a general approach. Say that despite the fact that we have rights, and in fact the anti-federalists point out that the Constitution, the body itself of the Constitution, there are half a dozen rights. And they turn this on the Federalists. They say, if your argument is correct, then all other rights are given up because we have only protections for half a dozen. That is, no bill of attainder, no ex post facto laws, trial by jury and criminal cases are guaranteed, etc. But there are only about a half a dozen of these rights. And so the anti-federalists say, using your argument that if they're not listed, they're given up. All other rights are given up. And so these two anti-federalists, Patrick Henry and Federal Farmer, they give a possible solution to this problem. And James Madison, who is an avid supporter of the Constitution, who is arguing against the Bill of Rights, it's not necessary. This is a government of delegated powers. He says, James Wilson says the same thing in Philadelphia. He puts forth the standard argument that becomes the Federalist Doctrine. There's no need for a Bill of Rights because the new central government doesn't have authority to deal with these issues of freedom of the press. Where is the danger in the Constitution? Now, anti-federalists find the danger. They say the copyright protection is there in the Constitution, and they have the power to tax. They can tax newspapers. They can tax publications. So they will find the dangers.
We hear a lot about, you know, the First Amendment, freedom of the press, Second Amendment with the right to bear arms. This Ninth Amendment is so vague. Tell me how it sort of enters discourse today or over the years, this sort of statement that just because we don't mention a right doesn't mean it doesn't exist. How has that been used by various groups over the years?
Okay, well, James Madison at that time thought it was pretty definitive that there would be rights that would be discovered, new rights that maybe were applicable someplace and not elsewhere, and that these rights should be covered. The courts throughout our history have been very, very reluctant to open up what they see is a Pandora's box, that if you use this amendment, where do we stop? Mm-hmm. And yet it was used pretty much for the first time back in 1965.
For the first time.
Yes.
Wow.
Other means were used to protect various rights. But in 1965, in a famous case, Griswold versus Connecticut, it was a Connecticut law that provided contraceptives were illegal. And it was sort of an amusing reason for that. They felt that contraceptives made sexual activity outside of marriage more likely. That is, if you had extramarital affair, if you could be fairly sure there'd be no pregnancy, you'd be participating in that more frequently.
Right.
And so they didn't want that immoral activity. So they passed a law saying contraceptives were illegal. And so the Supreme Court gets this case. And it was decided by Justice William O. Douglas, really one of the great liberal justices, that this law was unconstitutional. And he viewed that it was unconstitutional from the penumbras emanating from various amendments.
Now,
what does that mean, penumbras? If you would go out some evening and you'd see the haze around the moon, that's a penumbra. And so it's something that's given off from the moon. This is something given off from the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fourth and the Fifth Amendments. So these amendments have certain provisions that would allow for privacy. Obviously, we can see that in the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure here. But that's what the majority opinion was. But it was Arthur Goldberg who gave a concurring majority opinion, saying it was the Ninth Amendment that did this. So that was the first time that the court in a significant way said that the Ninth Amendment was there. Now, it's interesting to see that in Roe versus Wade, in the district court, the attorneys for Roe used the Ninth Amendment. But when it got to the Supreme Court and went directly from the district court to the Supreme Court, it was decided by the attorney not to use the Ninth Amendment because it was felt it was too radical. And so they went to the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, which had been used quite often to protect various rights. But there was a concurring opinion written by Douglas that did use the Ninth Amendment in that particular case.
The Ninth Amendment actually does remind me of language that I've seen in various contracts over the years saying something to the effect of, well, we're not stating this explicitly, and so it's not, you know, dealt with by this particular contract. And Constitution, I don't know, would you call it a contract?
Oh, some people would, yes. It would be among the people,
between
as
the
opposed
people
to a
government.
Compact among the states, yes.
But it sounds as if this Ninth Amendment wasn't even referred to much until 1965, then it didn't do much good, did it?
I remember when Judge Bork was testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee when he was nominated for the Supreme Court. He said he didn't know what the Ninth Amendment meant, and he thought it would probably have been good if it wasn't written. Well, Judge Bork wasn't confirmed, and I don't think that necessarily was a good thing for him to say.
Kind of honest, right?
Well, yes, but not wise for a judge to say he doesn't know what the Constitution means. And so it's there, and certainly the founders, men like James Madison, who wrote the amendment the way it is today, wanted it to be there as a safety valve. And it's just it's there to be used, and who knows when it might well be used.
Does it come up in discussion of same-sex marriages, you know, marriage amendment type stuff? Does
it certainly could. It definitely could.
Basically, it could come up in the discussion of any right that's not explicitly acknowledged.
That's true. And the founders understood that rights would be evolving. They saw that rights were different when they were alive than 100 years before. And so they didn't know what the future would bode for rights and what would be certainly unacceptable activity in the 1780s and 90s might well be perfectly normal activities later on. And the Ninth Amendment is there to make the Constitution adjustable to societal norms that are changing.
But what about the fact that you have slaves at this point? And, I mean, why did nobody consider it as perhaps suggesting that there were rights belonging to other people?
Well, there are various rationalizations that occur over that, and I think perhaps the most obvious was in Virginia when the Virginia Constitution was drafted in June of 1776, and they started their constitution that all men are created equal, and the right away the obvious reference is to slavery, and they added the words, when they enter into society. And so there was the provision that slaves and blacks, even freedmen, did not enter into our society when we were forming our Constitution. That wasn't the case in Massachusetts. The Constitution written by John Adams mainly starts out, Declaration of Rights, all men are created equal. And it's a slave-owning judge who on appeal looks at what's called the Quoog Walker case in 1783 and frees all the slaves in Massachusetts because of those words.
Really? Because of the state constitution?
So, well before the great emancipator Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
William Cushing, Chief Justice William Cushing, using the words of John Adams in the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights of 1780, freed all the slaves in Massachusetts.
Now, was that approach used by other slaves? I mean, because by the time we do get to the Civil War, states had, I think, northern states had pretty much uniformly outlawed slavery.
Yes. Now, they don't use a constitutional justification necessarily, looking at their own state constitutions. They do it in a different fashion. They use their own sense of morals, that this is wrong. And what they do, virtually every northern state, they pass a gradual emancipation law saying that from such and such a date, every child born to a slave woman will be free.
We're going to look at another amendment that seems to have sparked a lot of activity in the last couple hundred years, the 10th, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. That's the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, the last amendment in the Bill of Rights. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Kaminsky, and we are talking about three of the amendments that have become quite controversial in the ways that they've been used over the last couple of centuries. So tell us about this 10th Amendment. Why was it added in there? It sounds like a states' right declaration.
The one of the key arguments against the Constitution was the fact that it would establish a consolidated government, a national government. These are pejorative terms at the time. And that the states would either be very insignificant or maybe even obliterated. And you'd have a unitary government as existed in England. And so this is a big fear. And the discrepancy in the debate is over delegated powers. And so you see in Article 1, Section 8, a listing of delegated powers that Congress has. And they're quite significant. And this is really the only part of the Constitution where you have this kind of listing of powers. They're very general for the president, and the jurisdiction of the courts very general as well. And that was because they felt in a republic that they were establishing that the legislature was the most authoritative part of the government. But immediately after the delegated powers were listed, you have the Necessary and Proper Clause. And that is a controversial clause. The Federalists say, the supporters of the Constitution say, that this is important to have because there are various measures that have to be taken to implement the delegated powers. And although they haven't been specified, they are necessary and proper. And so that's only what it applies to. The anti-federalists, the opponents of the Constitution, they're not buying that. They're fearful. They look at the Constitution and they see the General Welfare Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, the Common Defense Clause. All these are red flags. And coupled with Article 6 of the Constitution, which is the Supremacy Clause. And the Supremacy Clause, it says that the Constitution, laws passed by Congress in pursuance of the Constitution, and treaties, these are the supreme law of the land, notwithstanding anything in state constitutions or bills of rights.
Oh, so it trumps anything in a state constitution. The federal constitution has the power over.
That's right. And who decides this? It's the federal judiciary that decides this. So this seems as if it's stacked against the states and against the people as well. And so there is this big debate over federalism. It was what caused the American Revolution. England was saying it had total power. In its Declaratory Act of 1766, it said Parliament had the authority to bind Americans in all cases whatsoever. The Anti-Federalists said that the Necessary and Proper Clause was a revisiting of the Declaratory Act, allowing Congress to do whatever it wanted to do. And so it was a very expansive authority for this new government, and they felt that something had to be done to address it.
They weren't particularly assuaged by the difference between an absolute monarch in England and an elected government in the fledgling United States?
Not particularly. In fact, they felt that the president might well work with the Senate. They were tied together. They certainly believed in the concept of separation of powers, and that was lost in the Senate, which had powers dealing with appointments and powers in ratifying treaties. These are generally executive powers. And so they saw that there could be a conspiracy among those. And then the president has the power to pardon and can pardon even before a trial takes place. And so any kind of tyrannical activity, any kind of treason that was planned or—
He could pardon his cronies.
That's right. and himself, in fact. And so this was a very dangerous thing that anti-federalists saw.
What are some of the concrete ways that this 10th Amendment was used then? What exactly were states demanding the right to do?
Well, what they wanted to do was pretty much re-establish Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation. And Article 2 said, in essence, that the states retained their sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and Congress had only those powers that were expressly delegated to it by the Confederation. And so when you get the debate, as epitomized by James Wilson of Pennsylvania, who is a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, he gives the first public explanation of what the Constitution should be from the Constitutional Convention. He does this on the 6th of October, 1787, in the courtyard of the State House in Philadelphia, where the Constitutional Convention met, where the Pennsylvania Assembly was meeting at the time. And what he said was that the Constitution only gives delegated powers. Don't worry. Only delegated powers. Right. And therefore, you don't need a Bill of Rights, because none of those rights have been touched by these delegated powers. Now, anti-federals don't buy that, and they give their explanation. And a federal farmer, again, is one of the great spokespersons here against this concept. And eventually, what the anti-federalist position is that it's a matter of opinion. It's whoever is going to decide the issue in contention. If it's Congress, Congress will probably go beyond what most people would expect would be a delegated power. And then it would be up to the president to enforce it. And if he enforced it, then it's up to the courts. And the courts generally were expansive in English history, and they would rule in favor of the central government. Later on, there's a quotation that it was attributed to Napoleon, whether it's true or not, I'm not sure. But he said, "The tools belong to the man who can use them." And that's what we're talking about here with the Constitution. It will be as expansive, as large as those who are governing make it to be.
But I'm still stuck on trying to figure out what it is that a state did that, you know, would go sort of against the federal government. In other words, with this 10th Amendment saying that the states have these powers that the federal government can't prohibit it from having, what kind of powers? What did a state, like let's say, you know, Virginia or Pennsylvania or whatever, what did they want to do that otherwise would be considered illegal? Or
the first and most important provision is taxing power. And so in the Constitution, it's provided that only the federal government has the power to tax imports, and that no government, no the federal government nor the state governments, could tax exports. This is for protection of slavery. To have that provision there. You couldn't eliminate slavery by taxing the commodities that slaves grew, tobacco and cotton eventually. But what the anti-federalists said is that since the federal government had the power, unrestrained power, to tax everything, poll taxes, excise taxes, import taxes, there would be no money left over for the states. And therefore, that interpretation of taxing power would just be tremendous for the federal government, leaving nothing for the states, and therefore they would be out of business because they would have no money. But this is true also, for instance, the first key issue is over a bank, Bank of the United States, and it's the constitutionality of that bank is in question. In the Constitutional Convention, it was ruled that the central government should not have the authority to charter a bank. Then they went on from there, and they put in eventually – now, that's in secret, so not too many people know about that. But at the time, we know about it now because the records have been divulged after Madison's death. But in the Washington administration, in setting up the taxing policies, it was decided we're going to have a bank, Alexander Hamilton, and this is going to be a semi-private public bank. That is, you could buy shares. The government would own certain shares, and private individuals would own shares. Now, the states' rights folks don't like this. They don't want a national bank. They want state banks. And in fact, banks are not very well liked. There are very few banks at the time in the country. So they don't want the federal government having this weapon of a bank. But you can go along and look at virtually everything that the states were doing that they felt could be infringed upon by the central government, because of the expansive authority. Remember, under the Articles of Confederation, there was no power to regulate trade. Now the central government was given power to regulate both foreign trade and interstate trade. What did that mean? They had no inkling of what that would eventually mean, the kind of authority that the central government would assume to regulate interstate trade.
So what are some of the controversial issues today where the 10th Amendment gets invoked?
The issue is, again, federalism. How much authority does the central government have versus the authority of the states? And you have some permutations off of that. One would be if the federal government starts a program and then doesn't follow through and fund it later on, but requires the states to have these programs. This has to do with all kinds of issues. Gun control issues are there. You can see that there are requirements that the federal government puts upon the states and saying state office holders, state and municipal sheriffs, let's say, and other authorities are required to do certain things under federal law. And this is objectionable to many individuals who don't want to see the intrusiveness of the federal government into all kinds of areas that the states are competent to handle. And not only are they competent in their judgment, but the diversity of the country is such that these issues should be handled differently.
I would guess that even something like education
absolutely
could be affected by that.
Absolutely, and certainly folks want to get rid of the Department of Education. I remember I was listening to Fresh Air, Terry Gross in Philadelphia, and she had a Tea Party person on, and he said he wanted to restore the Constitution the way it was written. And she asked, what are you talking about? And he answered, well, the 10th Amendment. She said, what does that mean? And he said then, it means that the Congress should have only those powers that are expressly delegated to it, and that all other powers are reserved to the states. Now, that was all that was said. There were two major mistakes in there. First of all, the word expressly is not there in the 10th Amendment. And in fact, when they debated the 10th Amendment in Congress, should this be sent to the states for ratification? One provision was, let's put the word expressly back in it, just as it was in the Articles of Confederation. And they voted it down. James Madison said, no, it's too hard. You cannot expressly delegate every single power. Right. You need the necessary and proper clause. And he pointed out the fact that under the Articles of Confederation, Congress did things that it wasn't authorized to do. One was the land ordinances. You have to have those. And yet there's no provision for it. And so he didn't want that word expressly put in. And in fact, John Marshall, in the famous case McCulloch versus Maryland in 1819, rules there are implied powers because that word expressly was not put into the 10th Amendment when it was debated in Congress. And then finally, what's reserved is not just to the states, but also to the people. Because there are certain powers that the states should not have as well, but only the people should retain. And so it's interesting that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights starts out with we the people, and it ends also with the people. The powers are reserved to the people.
And that puts an end for this conversation with John Kaminsky. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And looking at the 2nd, 9th, and 10th Amendments in the Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can be with us for the next hour of University of the Air.